Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Polari is a secret language that became popular in England and Wales from the 1930s to the 1960s, in theatres and variety halls, with gay men in particular using the slang as both a code to identify members of the community and also to speak freely amongst themselves without fear of exposing their sexuality. Homosexual sex was illegal in Britain until the passage of the Sexual Offences Act in 1967. Used to avoid imprisonment and violence, the slang is a mixture of Italianate phrases, rhyming slang and colloquialisms that varies somewhat depending on the group who use it. Although Polari reached the height of its popularity in the mid-20th century, its origins date back several centuries, with roots in a rudimentary language used for communication between sailors around the Mediterranean. It then grew into an earlier form of the language called Parliari, and was used by vagrants, performers, sailors, buskers, prostitutes and Romani travellers in the 1700s and 1800s. Parliari was made up of, in part, Romani words mixed with thieves' cant, a secret language of robbers and hustlers in Great Britain, and also backslang, pronouncing a word as if it was spelled backwards. When it found its way to Britain, it arrived mainly in port cities, and it gradually began to be used by gay men and female impersonators. Although Polari had Parliari as a base, once in Britain, it was transformed with a variety of influences in addition to the backslang. Those included Yiddish, Cockney rhyming slang, and American Air Force slang. Also incorporated was the broken Italian, which was used by street puppeteers who performed Punch and Judy shows. These shows have origins in the 16th century Commedia dell'arte, and they're still a common sight in many British seaside towns. In the latter half of the 1960s, the popularity of Polari began to fade in the gay community, based on several factors. When homosexual sex acts were no longer criminal, the need for a concealing language faded. By the 1960s, many began to think of it as somewhat vulgar, as it was often used to gossip about sexual encounters. At the same time, the radio sketch comedy show Round the Horn introduced two characters, Julian and Sandy, who spoke a version of Polari. Although many listeners thought these were gibberish words, introducing them to the mainstream further impacted their practical use as a secret or underground language. By the 1970s, Polari had declined in use dramatically, although some words such as drag or naff or camp found their way into common usage and they're still part of our everyday language. However, Polari is currently experiencing a little bit of a renaissance, with renewed academic studies, a short film in 2015 entitled Putting on the Dish, which was done entirely in Polari, and even an app for those who want to incorporate Polari into their day-to-day conversations. Here's an extract from that film, which was made by London filmmaking duo Brian and Carl. The film is freely available to watch on YouTube, and I'll put a link on the website page for this episode and in the show notes.
You from round here, then?
More or less.
Ina's the place to be. Bone of bats, what size are your plates?
10, I think.
What about your luppers? They're size 10 too. But you play the Striller's real boner.
Is this your usual spot?
How do you mean?
I've got your number, ducky.
Where's your flowery, then?
Clitterhouse Road.
Well, have a bend cove up that way. Pauline.
Pauline March?
That's the one. Can't swing a cat, but in a cove.
How is Pauline?
She's had an anti-bully fake. Dyed her eye, her ends a right mess.
Anti-boner. I hope she vagaried straight to the crimper.
Well, that's where she'd just been. Pallone tried to give her an Irish multi-palaver. Pauline told her to shove a shikel up a kyber.
She didn't say that.
Mate, we ducky ween, you're actual English.
She's all wind and piss, Pauline. She's there with Phyllis, then?
Haven't you heard? She's been a real boner over. Blowing the groundsels, ling-grappling dilly boys, trolling the back slums. She had to be battered twice last month.
She didn't.
Pauline's a stretcher case. Trolled in one notch, she devoured a Phyllis plating some shin bar she blagged in the brandy latch.
Dish the dirt.
It's all over grumble for Pauline. Nanti Denali, up to her elbow in the national handbag. She'd only just gone in for a remould. Had to refake her entire basket.
Putting on the dish has been credited by some with reviving a little of the interest in Polari. The film also features in a recent title from Reaction Books, Fabulosa, by Paul Baker. Paul is Professor of English Language at Lancaster University, and he recently spoke with Dr. Paul Cowdell of the Folklore Society, on our behalf, about the book and about Polari in general. Here's their discussion.
So, first off, welcome and thank you for coming on. Paul Baker, the author of the very lovely book, Fabulosa, The Story of Polari, Britain's Secret Gay Language, which came out a couple of years back in paperback from Reaction. I think we're only now belatedly catching up with a lot of things that were published over the last couple of years. Polari is, well, Paul, perhaps you could tell us what Polari is.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be invited onto the podcast. So Polari is a secret way of using language. I'm a bit cautious about calling it a full language. Some people have called it a language variety or even an anti-language. Some people have said it's just a slang or a collection of words. But putting all of those definitional issues aside, it's a type of language that was used for secrecy mainly by gay men in the early 20th century as a way of identifying each other, as a way of talking about topics that they couldn't have really talked about in public spaces, as a way of kind of forming a sense of community as well and initiating each other into that community, and also as a way of just having a laugh as being funny or camp. It's lots of things, but it's also fascinating.
Well, yes, yeah, and that comes across very clearly in the book. But that kind of sense of cohesive community building, and you're very careful in the book to explain that it's not just one community, but that sense of community building is precisely, I think, what appeals, what makes this book so valuable for folklorists, because you can see the generation of a self-identity. I wanted to, I mean, Polari is an extremely high-profile secret language, isn't it? It's hiding in plain sight.
It is now, yes. It wasn't so much in the 50s and earlier. I think it was never really written down properly. People did use it occasionally in diary entries and things like that, but it was hard to kind of get hold of unless you were part of that community. What changed all of that and has made it much more popular now is... goes back to the 1960s when it was used in a radio comedy sketch show called Round the Horn. And this was a weekly show that went out on Sunday afternoons. So it was also a family show, just kind of ironic that it had Polari in it, which is often has quite rude words in it. But they were in secret, so people couldn't understand necessarily what they meant. So this show had two characters called Julian and Sandy, who were played by Hugh Paddick and Kenneth Williams. And they were playing two out-of-work actors, very camp and quite obviously gay, I think, if you were kind of old enough to kind of spot that. And they would sort of chat away They didn't use an enormous amount of Polari. Obviously, if they had, you wouldn't have been able to understand the sketches, but they used enough here and there, so you could kind of often figure out what the words meant. And then they had the occasional longer phrases in as well. And these sketches were incredibly popular. The program itself was a very popular show. Whole families listened to it. And I think in a way that introduced Polari, or the concept of it, to the British population. And you know, that this was 1967 and onwards. So by that point, I think maybe it kind of lost a little bit of it, of its usefulness, you know, for people using it in secret contexts. I mean, it has been said that even by the late 60s, it was kind of on its way out anyway. It stopped being as fashionable as it was. So I think maybe a combination of just, you know, fashions changing, times changing, also the decriminalization of homosexuality in 1967. And then also Julian and Sandy kind of spoiling the secret a little bit, I think, kind of all contributed towards kind of making it less popular to be used by the gay community, but also making it more well-known outside the community at the same time.
And I mean, to some extent, I think its appearance at the time of decriminalization points to a decline in the need for the language?
That's a good question, yeah. I think decriminalisation didn't change everything overnight. And in fact, in some circumstances, it made things worse, because I think now it was sort of in the public eye and the police decided they were going to do something about it. So there was a bit of a backlash from certain members of the police, and the arrests actually went up, not down. But it did mean that there was a sort of change, I think, change in atmosphere. People felt that, for once, for the first time, they could assemble and without the fear of you know, being arrested just for being in a building with other people. And I think the younger people who maybe didn't have, you know, that long sort of experience of decades of having to hide themselves and be secretive, the younger people wanted more, and you know, expected more. So they campaigned for liberation. And that a lot of that was about being visible and being out. And Polari, which was this sort of language of secrecy, was seen as not really that helpful for those girls. It was also seen as a bit ghettoizing, and also a bit offensive as well. I think some people said, you know, some of the words in it and the way that it was used kind of were insulting towards ethnic minorities or towards women, and also insulting towards gay people themselves sometimes. So it was kind of seen as a bit surplus to requirements, I think, in the sort of 70s and 80s, and sort of had a bit of a dip.
Yes. Well, we'll come back to that. But if we could maybe go back a little to where did it come from?
Oh, that's a really...
What feeds into it?
Really good question. Lots and lots of different kind of sources that can come into it. I think the one that I would probably say is the clearest is something called Parliari, which already sounds like Polari. So you can sort of see the connection there. And Parliari was a language used in the 19th century, which was used by a range of kind of traveling people who were entertainers, buskers, beggars used it, people who worked in fairgrounds used it a bit as well. Sometimes call it slightly different names, but when, you know, I've looked at the different vocabularies associated, and there's quite a lot of overlap, even though we've got lots of different groups or using different words for different things, there is overlap. And Parliari seems to be the kind of term which they cluster around. These were people who were kind of on the fringes of society, I guess. They were kind of stigmatized. They often had no fixed abode, so they were traveling for work purposes from city to city. Some of them had traveled overseas. Some of them had been sailors. Some of them had worked on Punch and Judy store entertainment outfits, and then they'd come over to the UK as well. So you find bits of Italian in Parliari as well. And then some kind of older languages and slangs, cant, for example, which is a kind of Elizabethan form of language used by criminals, which has sort of overlaps again with Parliari. So you've got all these different people using this language, and it's not really associated with gay people at that point. It's associated more with entertainers. Gradually, it starts being used in more entertainment contexts. Gradually, then, it starts to kind of migrate into the Victorian music halls, the sort of late 19th century. And then from that, you have the sort of more established theatres of the 20th century in the West End. And that's when you start to see, you know, it being associated more with theatrical people. And then via those, you get its association with gay men. And that's why Julian and Sandy were cast as out of work actors. They were the kind of prototypical kind of Polari speakers. So that's one route. Another route is, I'll only do two. Another route is, is via the docks. So you've got also versions of Polari being associated with people, it was sailors who were kind of traveling around the Mediterranean and then coming back to port towns in the UK, places like Southampton, Portsmouth, also London, and the dock, particularly the docks of London as well, and the East End of London, where you've got all these other communities living, so, Jewish communities who are speaking Yiddish, then you've got EastEnders who are speaking Cockney rhyming slang as well. That all gets kind of mixed together, and then you've got this other kind of form of Polari which is coming out, which is less associated with the theatre, but more with the kind of Dockland areas and the kind of very vibrant communities and mixes there. So some people have even spoken about a West End version of Polari, a sort of theatrical version, and an East End version associated with docks. And the East End version was seen as more complicated and slightly better, I think, from those who spoke it. There's a bit of rivalry.
Which, I mean, and this is fascinating, because there's the discussion in the book about that you mentioned earlier about whether it's a language, an anti-language, a variant. All plays out, and you can see that in all of the variety of influences. So there's Romani, the Yiddish, but all of those things are also being used in other contexts. So I mean, that question of is it a language? One of the things that I got very strongly from the book was this idea that there might be this selective use of what defines it isn't so much the content of the language as its function within that group. So there'll be all sorts of overlaps with all sorts of groups who, you know, aren't anything at all to do with gay men. I'm very struck with the how can I put this, aggressively heterosexual Ewan McColl, including the word Polonies in a song. Because obviously he'd heard it from the truck drivers that he was writing about, but there's clear crossover.
Very much so, and you know, one group of people that I, you know, who used a version of it were in Newcastle, and there were kind of men who were using it there, who were sort of selling sex, but you know, to other men, but they didn't identify as gay themselves, and the same in London. You know, later on, you know, you've got sort of men hanging around Piccadilly Circus who are kind of using versions of it and using it kind of almost as a trade language, talking about words for sex and words for money, words for different types of clients. But these men were actually quite macho. You know, they weren't camp in any way. So kind of contrast those with men who were maybe using it in the 1930s who were quite camp, who were hanging around Piccadilly Circus selling sex, and they would wear makeup and have, you know, quite complicated hairstyles and things like that. And then they used it, you know, all sorts of sex, but in a different way. So you've got, you know, different contexts for it and different types of people who are using it, sometimes for the same reason, sometimes for different reasons. But I think, you know, I suppose the most well-known type of person using it is this kind of camp gay man from the 50s and a few earlier decades from before that as well, kind of hanging around, you know, urban centres, particularly around London, associated with theatre or the entertainment world in some way, or around Soho.
I mean, you talk in the book about one of its strengths, actually, for camp gay men under those criminalised conditions, being it is apart from the secrecy of what it enables you to communicate amongst yourselves, it is also an act of defiance on the appearance of Lily Law. You know, that it gives you a certain sort of waspish comeback. How much does that play out, and how much then is that sort of dissipated later?
Yeah, I mean, very, very much so. I mean, it was a kind of language of, I suppose, protection, but also, you know, aggression can be a form of defense as well, can't it? So I think they, you know, the people who used it, they used it for community, but they also used it to be, you know, quite waspish to each other as well. And there was quite a lot of banter or one-upmanship with it as well. Even, you know, showing that you were good at the language and better than somebody else was a form of getting one over on them. But then, you know, the kind of insults that they could use on each other, you still see sort of echoes of that in present day. That TV show RuPaul's Drag Race has a challenge where they have to sort of read each other and insult each other for humor. And it's very similar to what people were doing with Kalari, you know, kind of almost a century earlier. So yes, you have that sense of kind of aggression, sometimes tempered with kind of kindness as well, and sort of showing that, you know, I could be rude to you because we're such good friends, that sort of thing. But then they turned it outwards as well. So, you know, you mentioned Lily Law, which is the common term for the police. They had lots, you know, Betty bracelets, Hilda handcuffs.
The sad realities of the
brooch was one they used. Yeah, yeah. And they refer to a police station as the lily pad, for example. So they, you know, they kind of feminized the police quite a lot, made fun of them, you know, sometimes to their faces in Polari, they wouldn't get it. And you know, some of the speakers in the 60s talked about how if they were walking down the street and somebody gave them a dirty look, you know, kind of because they guessed they were gay, they would sort of turn back on them and start shouting insults in Polari at them. So there was that sort of sense of defiance there. Not with everybody, I think, but with some people who were maybe a bit bolder than others. So yeah, I think there was that sense of using it kind of almost aggressively, and also maybe to make fun of quite difficult circumstances as well. So, you know, being arrested or being beaten up, things like that, and to kind of almost to not make a drama out of that, to kind of, you know, kind of almost cast it as a triviality, and maybe to be more upset about something else, you know, to do with like maybe you've broken a fingernail during a fight or something, and you're kind of upset about that. Oh, by your clothing being ripped or something, rather than actually, you know, being actually physically bruised. You know, so, you know, I kind of got that impression as well that jokes were made, you know, in those difficult situations, sometimes in Polari as well.
Right. Which sort of brings me to one of the other very nice things in the book, which is how you place yourself within the research. It's very endearing. For one thing, but the reflexivity is also essential, and I think is kind of salutary is something folklorists will recognize. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved in the research in the first place?
Oh, it was Julian and Sandy that I mentioned earlier. I had a friend actually who was called Julian, and he had the tapes, and the BBC had released, I think, some audio tapes of Round the Horn in the 1990s, early 90s. And, you know, he said, have a listen to this. And we put them on and listened to them. And we found them very funny. And at the time, I was at Lancaster University, and I had the opportunity to do a PhD in linguistics. And, you know, I had sort of various topics in mind. And that, you know, of all the ones that I've had, I thought that actually probably would be the most interesting one to do, you know, kind of keep me motivated for the duration of the PhD. And I wasn't aware that anybody else was doing anything like that. And it was a mystery to me. You know, kind of the tapes themselves were a mystery with these Polari words on them, because I didn't know anyone who was using that language. And this was only a few years later, 30 years later or so, less than that. And so I didn't know any gay people who were using those words. And I thought, you know, it's kind of a mystery to why they've all gone away so quickly, what's happened in that short period. And I thought it would be a good challenge to kind of get the language down, because if it wasn't being used now, then it was likely that it would sort of die away very quickly and then be forgotten about. So I felt it would be, you know, a kind of interesting opportunity to get a record of that language as much as I could, get it all down. I didn't want to necessarily revive it, but I wanted to have it recorded. And I wanted also to get some idea of the stories of the people who spoke it as well, what their lives were like. Why they spoke it, in what contexts, and how it created communities and things like that as well. So I did interviews with speakers and went around Brighton and various cities as well, trying to find people. And it was It was fun. It was also quite challenging because I was quite young and quite shy. And a lot of the people I met were quite larger than life and had lived very interesting lives as well. So I kind of was quite happy to point a tape recorder at them and let them speak for an hour or two and just tell me about their lives. Fortunately, I didn't have to say very much back. But it was a great privilege to be able to talk to these people. It wasn't a very typical PhD, I think, in terms of, you know, for linguistics, looking at, you know, kind of, I don't know, the structures of language in some way. It was a much more kind of socially oriented PhD. And then kind of brought in lots of theories from queer theory and things and sociology and things like that as well. So it was a nice mixture of things. And I enjoyed it a lot.
And it's, I mean, there are one or two lovely anecdotes of you as a fresh-faced researcher in the field for the first time, just being kind of confronted with this deluge of Polari.
That's right, yes. And one of the people I interviewed was a drag queen in living in Brighton. And I'd never met anybody like that before. And so it was just this sort of contrast. And this world that the drag queen lived in, I mean, they were having their hair, a wig fitted, you know, kind of it was a Saturday afternoon and sort of they'd fit me in to speak. And so they were having this kind of big wig fitted and this hairdresser would come around and was kind of teasing this wig into this huge style. And there were lots of people outside running around and swearing and shouting at each other. It was all very, very chaotic. And the drag queen was kind of trying to hold court over them all because she was in charge and kind of telling them to shut up and say, recording this, go away. And they kept popping their head around the door and shouting and things. It was crazy, really, but great fun.
I mean, I wonder, and you talked about trying to document this before it disappeared to some extent. To what extent did you find there's still that stubborn kind of persistence of it amongst the people that you were talking to, that it kind of becomes, had it become secret again?
I think to an extent it had become forgotten, yeah. Definitely the older people that I interviewed still did use it. They didn't use it as much as they used to. And so their vocabulary was smaller and the number of contexts they used it in was smaller too. So it tended to be more they would use it maybe with friends their own age, say at a dinner party or something. And then they'd use the odd word and then they'd have a laugh. But it certainly wasn't, you know, kind of on the gay scene, wouldn't sort of hear it kind of used lots in pubs and clubs. Although from what I've heard, people in the theatrical world did still continue to use it, you know, all the way through. And that still, you know, is known and used in the backstage and in dressing rooms and things like that. And in the UK, you still get to hear it in certain circumstances.
That was where I first heard it and sort of continued to hear it outside of Julian and Sandy.
Right.
And certainly, you know, theatrical usage. And it wasn't a vast, flexible vocabulary in the way that you've described with gay men. But there was certainly, you know, kind of an undercurrent, a residual core of vocabulary that was in regular use.
Yes.
And I still hear
words. Yeah. Words like lallies and boner and things like that probably being used quite a lot in those contexts. And then people sort of laughing when they hear them used. Yeah. So I think it did. It kind of reduced, you know, in all sorts of ways, kind of the number of words being used, the number of times it's used and the context all kind of getting smaller and smaller. But not going away completely, I think. And then you have this very interesting kind of almost like a twist in the story that kind of changed in events in the sort of early 1990s when you have this kind of almost like a rediscovery of it for political purposes as well, which is kind of very interesting because before that, it's been criticised within gay communities as being apolitical or kind of, you know, politically incorrect. And then you get these kind of more politicised people from a different group in the late 80s, early 90s called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, who are a group of gay men who dress as nuns, and they have these ceremonies where they bless you know, gay people or make them saints if they've done a lot for the community, or they carry out partnership ceremonies. And this is long before there was civil partnerships or gay marriage. And so they start using Polari in this very ceremonial way, in these situations. And for them, they say it's kind of like a dead language, a bit like how Latin is to Catholics. So they're using it in the same way in their ceremonies, to give their ceremonies a bit of, I suppose, exotic feeling, a bit of glamour, a bit mystical. And so that they're using these in this way. And also to be quite politically defiant as well. This is a period where you've got Section 28, the law which forbade promotion of homosexuality by local education authorities. You've got HIV/AIDS, and the media having this huge kind of moral panic around gay men in particular. And so it's kind of quite a kind of dark time, I think, to be LGBT plus. Attitude surveys, I think there was one in 1987, which suggested that something like 75% of people thought that homosexuality was always wrong or mostly wrong. So a large proportion of the population were quite anti-gay at that point. So you have the sisters using Polari in this kind of more celebratory way, to kind of make a political statement. We're going to have these sermons, we're going to bless people, make them saints. They sing to them, Derek Jarman, I think most famously, the filmmaker. And this was just a few years before he died of HIV-related illnesses. And he said it was one of the happiest days of his life when they kind of made him a saint. And they did it at his home by Dungeness, and they had him on the beach and they took him in the water and kind of baptized him as well. So it was... That was really the start, I think, of a kind of reassessment of Polari. Some of the people involved in that wrote a couple of papers on it, chapters, articles, and then academics started to get interested in it again. And so you have this kind of new set of people who are finding it interesting. And then businesses start to pick up on it as well. So you get this sort of sense of it becoming something that businesses can use to kind of advertise, this is a gay venue. So you've got clothes shops and restaurants and bars calling themselves after Polari words. And then people having cocktail menus in Polari, for example, in certain places. Or there's now a clothing range, which is called Polari, with Louis Tomlinson from One Direction modelling clothes with big hoodies with the word Polari across the front of it. So you get a sense it's becoming kind of quite gentrified in a way, with all this kind of interest in it. Quite respectable, established people, playwrights writing plays about Polari and historians and linguists and things. So it's come a very long way from its kind of roots when it's associated with these kind of working class camp gay men or prostitutes kind of 100 years earlier, which is getting quite interesting and funny. Most languages don't go on that sort of route, I think. They either just go, die out, are forgotten, but they don't get this kind of fun revival. So it's quite a lucky language, I think, in some ways.
Yeah, the description of the businesses, it just sounds like a literalization of Julian and Sandy's latest Bonaventure, doesn't it?
Exactly, yes. Yes, Bona Togs and things like
yes,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
and that question, and I'll kind of wrap it up fairly soon, but that question I think does bring neatly back to the beginning, and Polari's magpie taking of bits to make its own language, to create its own usages, and that's continuing in lots of ways, lots of unpredicted and very different ways. Do you see Can you get any sense of a future trajectory for Polari, or what's coming out of Polari?
It's hard. Yeah, I don't think it's going to go away. I'm always interested in what people are doing with it in a way that I wouldn't have predicted, and particularly younger people and people who are kind of involved in the creative arts as well. So, it's sort of sense that younger people are discovering it, being quite delighted by it when they discover it, and then thinking of new things to do with it. So somebody created an iPhone app a while ago with it, lots of artists have used it in quite creative ways. There's been plays kind of put on about it as well. you know, the clothing brand is another nice example too. So it feels like it has the capacity to continue to change with people continuing to add new words to it to kind of suggest kind of, you know, more modern concepts, you know, so things like the internet or Facebook, I think, you know, you could sort of, you know, update it to have words like Facebook on there or Twitter or things as well. You know, I think the internet is what, in a way, is another reason I think why it's not going to go away completely, because, you know, if you type in Polari into, say, Twitter or something to search, you know, there's, you know, there's conversations, you know, every day someone's talking about it still. So, you know, there's probably a lot more discussion about it now than there was 30 years ago, just due to the internet and you know, my book and other people who've written things about it as well. So I think, you know, it happily is recorded for posterity, which is nice to know. And it's always nice seeing new people, you know, writing to me, still write to me, you know, a lot, you know, saying they've just discovered it and they're fascinated by it and they'd like to do this project on it or something. Would I help them, advise them? That's lovely.
Great. Yeah.
Happening. Yeah. Obviously, it's not the same as it was when they're using it 100 years ago, but it's always changed. So one thing that people sometimes do is they take the dictionary that I created, which, you know, has lots of layers, different levels of words from different time periods and different types of users, and they kind of mix it all up together, and then they kind of create this new version of Polari, which is just everything in the kitchen sink all kind of thrown in together. And I think probably nobody would have spoken Polari in that way, because it's just too much, it's everything. And they would have had their own little versions. And so they're kind of creating this kind of super version of it now, sometimes, which probably isn't how it would have been used. But that's fine. You know, there's no reason why Polari has to stay the same. And, you know, it never was about staying the same. It was always about changing. So it should be allowed to develop in whichever way people want to develop it. And it's still Polari, that's okay.
Yes, yes. And in a way, I think that's a positive thing. You talk in the book about how when the sisters create this high Polari, it has a sort of rather rarefied, ritualized use. But what you're talking about here is people trying to make it adaptive and using it for their own immediate purposes. So what will determine its future is how far those uses are taken on and become integral to the community that's using it.
That's right. Yeah. And I don't think the communities are going anywhere. In fact, you know, I think in some ways, you know, we talk about the LGBT plus Q community, but it's really lots of communities. You know, and even if you take one of those letters within that, you used up lots and lots of communities within that too. And that's how it's always been. I mean, the idea of communities is a very useful one, I think, to kind of rally around. But when you sort of get it down to the, you know, the ground, you know, it's small groups of people interacting. Maybe people going to the same bar, but, you know, you've got your friends as well, and they're constantly changing. And that's, I think, why it was so difficult to kind of get a sense of what Polari was, because everyone was using it in these small groups. And everyone was using a slightly different version of it and inventing their own words as well. So you've got kind of a core vocabulary, and then you've got this massive fringe vocabulary of lots of different people using it in different ways. And I think that has the potential to continue as well, which is lovely.
And as you say, your book, I think, is has itself fed into that. And I'm going to conclude now by making a kind of an urgent appeal to the podcast's readers. If you haven't already read this book, do, because it's absolutely great. It was, you know, this was something with which I was not unfamiliar, but there's a lot in it that's going to be new to anybody who's come to Polari, you know, he comes even with some background in Polari. And so just once again, I want to thank Paul Baker for this lovely book and for having a chat with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's a great pleasure. Thanks.
My thanks go to Professor Paul Baker and Dr. Paul Cowdell for a fascinating look into the world of Polari. It's an interesting area of crossover between linguistics and social history and folklore. You can get a copy of Paul's book, Fabulosa, published by Reaction Books, from all good bookshops. And do also take a look at the film Putting on the Dish on YouTube as well. We have a couple of great live online events coming up in December, for which tickets are now available. On Monday the 12th, you can enjoy an audience with Danny Robbins, the creator of Battersea Poltergeist and Uncanny, and a new series for BBC Radio 4 just announced, The Witch Farm. Danny's also the author of the West End hit play 222, A Ghost Story. You'll have a chance to put your questions to Danny after the discussion. And then, on Saturday the 17th of December, you can enjoy some chilling winter tales with professional storyteller and host of the Time Between Times podcast, Owen Staton. Tickets for these events are only £5 each, and money helps to support the work of the Folklore Library and Archive, our organisation dedicated to the preservation of folklore materials. You can get tickets now from the online store on our website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com. Additional material for this episode was written by Tracy Nicholas. Thanks for listening. See you next time.